Florida's history with voter suppression, COVID, and the veteran experience, and talking with South Florida artists from a rocking chair. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida has a long history of voter suppression, with a series of policies and laws targeting Black communities. We're going to look into some of that history and if the courts might keep thousands of Floridians from voting in November. Also, thousands of veterans struggle to find homes, work, and health care. The pandemic has made it even harder. And finally,
the rocking chair is really kind of creating this moment where they can also relax and where we were like tongue-in-cheek saying also it's kind of like a therapy session.
We introduce you to the Rocking Chair Sessions, a podcast with artists who chat about their work and psychology from a rocking chair. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. We are a little more than 6 weeks away from November's general election. There are a lot of questions about whose votes will be counted in Florida and who will be able to cast a ballot. Last week, a federal appeals court ruled that former felons will be required to pay back fines and fees before regaining their right to vote. It's the latest in a series of legal challenges to felons' voting rights in the state, which were to be restored after voters overwhelmingly approved Amendment 4 back in 2018. Dexter Filkins is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest piece shows that this legal battle is part of a decades-long intentional effort by Republican leaders in the state to restrict voting rights and whose ballots are counted. The Uncounted is in the September 7th issue of The New Yorker, and we've included a link in our social media. Dexter Filkins joins us now via Skype. Dexter, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Dexter, you know, access to voting rights, I mean, it's a national story. You have concerns about voter ID laws in North Carolina and Georgia, to the challenges posed by the pandemic and securing polling places and vote by mail. But why did you want to look specifically at this issue in the state of Florida?
Well, you know, there was the case that you just mentioned, Amendment 4, which, I mean, was pretty clearly written. It said the rights of felons, basically for anyone who'd served their sentence, unless it was for murder or rape, they served their sentence, their voting rights would be automatically restored. And they actually used the word automatically. And then, as you mentioned, it was passed by something like close to 65% of Florida's voters voted to approve that. And nonetheless, the legislature almost immediately basically attached conditions to that and said, not so fast. Your voting rights are not going to be restored automatically. First, you have to pay your fines and restitution and penalties and anything like that that was outstanding. And so I wanted to take a look at that. And as I did, what became clear was that it wasn't just one case. There's a whole history dating back at least 20 years of basically Republican-driven efforts to make it, I don't know how else to say it, to make it harder to vote. Because essentially the Republican Party, I think, has determined, and I think correctly determined, that that they benefit from low turnout elections. That's now, how they win.
And I want to ask you about that. But when you look at that history over the last 20 years, to what extent is our state indicative of voting issues nationwide, or is it a category all its own?
Well, there's a guy quoted in my story named Mark Elias. He's a big voting rights attorney. And he said, Florida's been at the vanguard. It's an exporter of this virus. So I'd put it that way. There's a lot of states that have experimented and are doing various things like that to keep turnout low and to make it harder to vote. But Florida is really an outlier. It's way, or a leader, really, a leader in the field. It's been kind of at this for almost 20 years.
And you look at those 20 years. So let's go back to 2000 and look at some of that history. And I want to look at the story of when Secretary of State then Catherine Harris sent a list of presumed felons to be purged from voter rolls during that election back in 2000. Why did she do that?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, I was well into my story, and I'd not heard anything about this. And then someone mentioned this to me, and I started looking at it, and really my jaw fell open. The state government, which at the time was Governor Bush and Secretary of State Catherine Harris, decided we are going to find any felon that is registered to vote in Florida, and we are going to ensure that they are taken off the voter rolls. And what they did, and this is why it was so shocking, they used this kind of very, very shoddy computer company. It was called Database Technologies. And they did this kind of incredibly broad search where they came up with something like 100,000 names of people who they said are felons who are registered to vote in Florida. So Catherine Harris, Secretary of State, sent these letters out saying, here are 700 felons in your county who are on your voter registration rolls, take them off. And here's 500 in your county. But what happened, and what was discovered over time, it caused chaos, but only after the election, was that list was kind of a joke. I mean, a terrible, a bad joke, but that it was totally and grossly inaccurate, and that the overwhelming majority of people on that list targeted as felons were not felons. And so people were thrown, thousands of people were taken off the voter rolls and couldn't vote that day. And at least 20,000. And if you remember, the President Bush's margin of victory in 2000, which came down to Florida, was 537 votes. So you're talking about a number of people excluded from the ballot that exceeds the margin of victory by like 40 times.
Yeah.
So you can trace the 2000 election, which some of your listeners are old enough to remember, right back to that decision. It was just pretty shocking.
When you look at those names that were taken off, and as you said, many cases in which the individuals had no criminal record, but do we know if their names were added back at any point afterwards?
It's a really good question. I mean, the list was so bad that, just as an example, the supervisor of elections in Gadsden County, supervisor of elections was on the list herself as a convicted felon. And so these supervisors of elections, when they came to realize what had happened, was until after the election, kind of painstakingly went back and tried to put these people back on. But that's basically what happened. So you're talking thousands of people who couldn't vote in the 2000 presidential election, in what, of course, became this cliffhanger race.
Yes.
So it was potentially decisive in the presidential election.
Because as you point out, it was a very, very close race. Let's look at how this issue reared up again during the Rick Scott administration not too long ago. When he was elected into office, he implemented a series of restrictive measures, limiting the hours of early voting sites. He reduced the number of days allowed for early voting and preventing third-party groups like the League of Women Voters to register individuals. What impact did limiting early voting on Sundays have historically for Black churches?
Well, Rick Scott is really the champion of these efforts. I mean, it goes back to the 2008 election when Obama won, when President Obama first won, and the Republican Party sort of looked at the coalition that Obama had assembled and said, holy cow, that's a coalition that's young. It's, you know, basically it's young people, Black people, college educated. That coalition is young and it's growing and getting bigger, and ours is not. So the legislature under Scott started to pass all these laws that were sort of tightening and shortening voting periods, making it harder to register. And what had happened in the vote in the Black community across Florida, across the South, really, you have this really amazing phenomenon called Souls to the Polls. And Black people go to Black churches, predominantly Black churches, on the Sunday before the election. And then afterwards, you know, the minister, the pastor says to them, everybody go to the polls. And that's Souls to the Polls. And so they all go there to vote a couple of days before the election. And so a result of that, in 2008, 2012, you had these massive turnouts in the Black community, not just in Florida, but across the South. And so that was the first target of Governor Scott, which is we've got to limit early voting, which they did, which they chopped the number of days that you could vote early, and they made it harder to register to vote. And there's no other reason for that except they want to drive turnout down.
Yeah, one of the people you spoke with in your story was a Reverend R.B. Holmes Jr. of the Bethel Missionary Baptist Church in Tallahassee. He was part of that Souls to the Polls tradition, as you talked about. But yeah, how else did he incorporate the issue of voting in his sermon?
Well, he's an amazing guy. It's a really extraordinary institution with quite a history going back to the civil rights movement in Tallahassee. And so I was there the Sunday before the primary, the statewide primary. And it was amazing. And Reverend Holmes basically gave a sermon about voting. I mean, he said, this is the most important election of our lifetimes. And, you know, it's important for everybody here to exercise the right to vote. And after the service, everybody walked down to the courthouse downtown. It's about a half mile away, the whole congregation. And everybody voted early. So it was quite a wonderful scene, an incredible scene, really. And disappointing that some people are threatened by it.
I'm wondering if people that you spoke with in the congregation, what do they say about voter suppression efforts? They must know throughout history, not just the last 20 years. We're talking about throughout our history, U.S. history. But what do they say about it?
Well, if you're sitting in a black church in Florida, it's no surprise to anyone there that this kind of thing goes on. I mean, as you say, before voter suppression and, you know, from Reconstruction, in the end of Reconstruction in the late 1870s all the way to the 1960s, it was basically impossible for black people to vote in the South. And so this stuff is not, it's not a surprise to them. But what was really striking being at that church is just how galvanized they were and how politicized they were. I mean, that whole church went down and voted. So I found, at least the congregants of that church, that were absolutely determined to vote, not just in the primary, but in November.
We're talking with Dexter Filkin, staff writer for The New Yorker. His recent piece looks at how Republican lawmakers in Florida have time and again worked to suppress different voter groups here in the state over the past few decades. You could look at check out his story on our website, WLRN.org. Dexter, we saw the first impacts of the coronavirus and voting in Florida with the March presidential primary, then again in August. Before the March primary, supervisors of elections had asked the governor to fulfill a series of requests to ensure safety of poll workers to run a successful primary. How did Governor DeSantis respond to those requests?
Well, he waited a couple of months to get back to them. And when you read this letter, it's kind of remarkable. It's signed by every single supervisor of election in the state. So that's every supervisor in 67 counties in what is a nonpartisan job. They're basically saying to the governor, we need help here because, you know, we have the pandemic. We're going to have tons of people coming to the polls. We're going to have like lots of mail-in voting. We need help. We need you to expand the time that we can count votes. We need, you know, basically we need a massive education effort. And it was a whole list of things, basically. And we need to know right now is what they said. And I think the governor waited 2 months to get back to them, more or less ignored the requests, granted them a few things. I mean, basically said that the election workers can start counting mail-in voting votes early. But on some of the really crucial things, like basically beefing up the number of workers, the poll workers at the precincts, and kind of opening up basically portable precincts, based on conditions at the time, he basically blew them off. Yeah. And it's hard. I tried to be as fair as possible, and I was looking at this stuff, and it's difficult to reach any conclusion other than that the Republican Party has an interest in kind of lower turnouts. What they say, of course, is we're trying to prevent fraud, you know, and that's kind of the mantra, which is, you know, we're trying to keep voting honest. And you know, that's an appealing slogan, but they're just, you know, you have to search high and low for any evidence of voting fraud anywhere, not just in Florida, but around the country. I mean, it's basically non-existent. And so that's why it's sort of, it makes you scratch your head.
You know, by all accounts, I mean, the August primary in Florida went off successfully, no major hitches. But on the Florida Roundup, we spoke with the University of Florida professor Dan Smith about the concerns he has for November.
When you talk about the November election, you know, we're going from 4 million to likely 9 million votes cast. So things may have been smooth in August. And, you know, generally speaking, they were. There are some hiccups every election. But we are probably going to double the volume of votes coming in.
So, Dexter, I mean, how are supervisors of elections getting ready for, you know, this potential deluge of mail-in votes?
It is a potential deluge. I spoke to there's a database analyst that I interviewed in my story who said that Florida is projected, they're basically projected to have 4.2 million mail-in votes. And I think what you have to do, I mean, what's really scary to me, and not just in Florida, but in other states around the country, is that, you know, you have these deadlines, and they're really, really hard deadlines. And so in Florida, your ballot, in order to be counted, your mail-in ballot has to arrive by election day, by when the polls close. If the ballot's not there, so if the mailman didn't deliver it, or if there was some problem along the way, then your vote's not counted. And so if you look at the 2018 election, and there were a series of really close elections there. I mean, all the statewide elections.
Yeah, we had a few recounts.
You had three statewide recounts. It was crazy, you know. In I think primarily Rick Scott and Bill Nelson and then the governor's race, but there were 15,000 ballots that were not counted because they came in after election day. And what was remarkable is like there was something like 170,000 ballots that arrived by mail on election day or the day before. So, you know, you're just talking about basically waves of ballots are coming. And so if there's any hitch in the postal service or in mail delivery, you're going to have hundreds of thousands of ballots that are not going to be counted because they didn't get there by election day. And, you know, this is Florida and the elections are really, really close. I mean, Rick Scott beat Bill Nelson by 10,000 votes. That's smaller than the margin of votes that weren't counted.
Yeah.
And so that's what's really scary here. I mean, because it's particularly when you have, you know, the president talking about, you know, defunding the post office. So it's definitely it makes you sit up straight.
You know, I mean, coming back to this idea, we've heard the president say before that, you know, attacking basically mail-in ballots. But what evidence do we have to suggest that early voters and those who vote by mail especially are largely Democrat?
We don't. I mean, we don't. I think there's a little bit of evidence that in this election in November, more Democrats are taking advantage of, that they're making use of mail-in voting. But I think that's primarily, you know, to be honest, I think it's primarily because the president's been bad-mouthing it and saying it's corrupt and it's fraud, even though, of course, he votes by mail himself. But the historically, it's been the Republicans have taken greater advantage of mail-in voting than Democrats have. They've made greater use of it. And that's only starting to change in this election, I think primarily because of what the president said. But it's basically been a Republican. It's been very good to Republicans in the past.
You know, coming back to the felon voting rights, it's unlikely that many are going to be able to regain that right to vote before November. But, you know, Desmond Meade was among the vocal leaders for Amendment 4. And now he and other civil rights activists continue this fight. But do you see this heading maybe to the U.S. Supreme Court?
It's possible. I mean, the 11th Circuit, the last step before the Supreme Court in Atlanta, basically upheld the DeSantis law that says gotta pay your money. So basically, what has to happen here for the Supreme Court is the ACLU, which basically backed the felons, the former felons, has to make a decision. And I think there's a clock on that. There's something like 90 days, but the where they could go to the Supreme Court and say, please make a rule on the ruling on this and make it quickly. But what's happening is the clock is running. And so the voter registration deadline in Florida is October 5th. And so, I mean, this would have to happen at kind of record speed. And I think in all likelihood, it won't. And I, you know, the ACLU hasn't decided to appeal. And if the Supreme Court got it, it's a huge case. You know, it's famous around the country. They'd want to take their time. And so I think in all likelihood, the kind of close to 800,000 former felons who were, you know, affected by Amendment 4, the overwhelming majority of them are not going to be able to vote in November.
I just want to finish with this. You know, a lot of your career, you spent overseas covering politics in India, wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, and I'm wondering, as you've investigated this voter suppression here in Florida over the years, have you ever seen anything like this in some of the younger democracies around the world?
I have. It's funny you mention that. I think what is most disturbing to me about, and the most disturbing parallel that I've seen, not just in Florida, around the country, is the polarization. I mean, it's basically like if you're in, I spent a lot of time in Pakistan and they've had, you know, kind of tumultuous, you know, on again, off again, democratic rule, interspersed with military dictatorships. There's no consensus in that country on kind of what they are. You know, are we a secular republic or are we an Islamic state or whatever? But that's what's happening in America. I mean, it's like, and it's you know, the terms are different, but it's like we've become that polarized. We can't agree on anything. We look at the same thing and we see different things. And that's what's so disturbing to me. It's like polarization, because we're getting to the point where, like, you know, we can't talk to each other.
Yeah. Yep. We hear that a lot. Absolutely. Well, as we said, we barely have 6 weeks left before this election, and as you mentioned, for the opportunity for felons to be able to get their right to vote, it would have to be record speed going through the courts for them to have that opportunity again as registration comes up here in early August. The New Yorker's Dexter Filkins, again, check out his latest piece about voter suppression in Florida on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dexter, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, still to come, the pandemic is creating an even greater challenge for veterans in need. What are the VA and local groups doing to assist? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. 3,000 veterans have died from COVID-19 so far this year. To give you some comparison, 4,400 U.S. soldiers have died in the Iraq War since 2003. Many veterans are particularly vulnerable to the virus, suffering from pre-existing conditions that they received in combat and thus putting them at higher risk. And for those suffering from PTSD, well, the social isolation poses an entirely new set of challenges. Dr. Jennifer McDonald is the chief consultant to the Veterans Health Administration's Deputy Undersecretary for Health. And we spoke to her last week about the VA's ongoing outreach and expansion into telemedicine during the coronavirus pandemic.
Thanks to early and active planning for the effects of the pandemic, we have been able to move early and often to keep veterans safe. We know that veterans are resilient, that they are often the ones during this time taking care of others, taking care of their families and loved ones. And so it has been critically important. And even for those listening today, I would love for them to hear from veteran to veteran that VA is here for you. Veterans are always our first priority, and you matter most to us. We are here for you. We have been open throughout the pandemic for all necessary care, and we welcome those veterans who need care and support during these times to come see us.
But I want to come back to that number again that was reported, 3,000 deaths to COVID. I mean, how does the VA see that? I mean, the programs that you have in place, everything you've done, is that success?
We have been proud to stand alongside veterans and their family members as they battle this virus, as the country battles this virus. And we are proud to take care of those who are affected by this. And as we move with the resiliency and the agility in our system and the dedication of our employees to take care of veterans, we have been proud to see that our early and proactive moves to move to telehealth, to grow telehealth by more than 1,000%, to provide more than 800,000 pieces of personal protective equipment to communities to help veterans and their loved ones stay safe. We're proud to see that those efforts are coming to fruition and that communities are beginning to heal from what we've all experienced.
I want to look at South Florida, one of the hardest hit regions in the state and in the country. Our cases spiked back in June and July, and at that time, the Miami Herald reported 30 healthcare workers at Miami's Veterans Affairs Hospital tested positive for the virus over the course of a week. What has the VA done to ensure that its healthcare workers are safe? Because they're in the front lines of this.
Absolutely, and this is a top priority for us. We moved early to make sure that our frontline providers and those working in our facilities, even who weren't a direct part of healthcare, had the personal protective equipment that they needed. And as a veteran and someone serving in VA, I'm proud to say that throughout the duration of the pandemic, we have been able to meet the needs of those employees and make sure that they are safe. We have even been able to go above and beyond and deliver those additional nearly 800,000 now pieces of personal protective equipment to communities around us. We have even moved to 3D print our personal protective equipment, some of it, and be able to deliver those resources to other hospitals and other communities and help veterans and their loved ones stay safe right where they are, even before they reach our facilities.
You know, a few weeks ago, we spoke with the union head for the Miami Postal Service workers, and she had mentioned a lack of funding and an increase in the supply of mail because of the pandemic, and that's led to a significant delay in the mail. A lot of veterans depend on the Postal Service for their medication. So what is the VA advising to veterans in these circumstances? Should they seek alternative methods to get their prescriptions?
In every aspect of care delivery, from prescriptions to the direct care that is needed in person or via telehealth, we are following up with each veteran in our care and doing a tremendous amount of outreach to make sure that people have what they need and they are cared for. Veterans are telling us that indeed they do, but we would welcome anyone with a concern to come to us.
Does that mean the VA will compensate veterans if they're having to have additional costs in getting their medications?
We would love for veterans to contact us about any issue they're having with their medications. At this time, we are following up with each and every person and making sure that those needs are fulfilled.
We know there are about 2,300 veterans experiencing homelessness across Florida. That's according to the 2019 Florida Council on Homelessness annual report. And we've talked about this issue a lot on our show about the vulnerabilities that these folks face during the pandemic. What kind of programs are there right now to reach out to these folks and help them?
Outreach to vulnerable populations is at the top of our priority list. We have done a tremendous amount of outreach into these communities and to homeless veterans specifically to make sure that they are safe, not only from COVID-19, but from the additional natural disasters that have occurred. When there's a hurricane impact on a community, for instance, we reach out to every single one of those vulnerable veterans in our care and make sure that they are safe and cared for. The CARES Act that our congressional stakeholders have given us has also provided an enormous amount of flexibility. We have been able to proactively help those who are at risk of homelessness stay in their accommodations, and we've been able to rapidly rehouse veterans and help prevent some of the effects of COVID that otherwise might take hold. That is some of the work we are most proud of, and we are very focused on their safety and will continue to be throughout the duration of the pandemic.
That was Dr. Jennifer McDonald, Chief Consultant to the VA, and we've included more information on the VA's fourth mission on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, as we've heard, this pandemic has been especially hard on veterans. Financially, physically, and emotionally, this virus has taken a toll on a community that was already vulnerable. Oftentimes, those who served aren't getting the help they need. They're the last ones to reach out and take advantage of the benefits. Local organizations here in South Florida have stepped up to help veterans who've fallen through the cracks of the bureaucratic systems like the VA. Joining us now is Seth Eisenberg. He's the president and founder of Operation Sacred Trust, a nonprofit organization that helps veterans transition out of homelessness. Seth, always great to talk to you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm delighted to be here.
You know, Seth, tell me, how do you think the VA has handled the pandemic, and what role should they be playing?
Yeah, there's no question that the VA has been incredibly forthcoming with resources. You know, we've Operation Sacred Trust started 9 years ago, and never in our history have we seen the VA react so rapidly to provide resources to public-private partnerships like Operation Sacred Trust in the field to make sure that there's no resource missing to help veterans who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. And that's made a big difference because we have, you know, today we have over 200 veterans in hotels here in South Florida because despite the moratorium on evictions, have not been able to stay in their accommodations or didn't have housing to begin with. We have a almost fourfold increase in the number of veterans who are at risk of imminent homelessness that we're serving. We've been very grateful that VA has stepped up and literally doubled the financial resources available to us very quickly so that we could help meet these needs in our community.
And remind us again, how does your organization differ from the VA?
VA, back about a decade ago, recognized that in order to end veteran homelessness, they needed public-private partnerships, that government alone could not do it. When they looked at the results across the country at a time when nearly 100,000 veterans were homeless on any given night in this country, they realized that they needed to try something different and new. And the kind of rapid, flexible response that is needed for each and every unique veteran who experiences homelessness or the risk of homelessness is not something a bureaucracy is really geared up to support. So what the VA did instead is created 300 public-private partnerships across the country, of which Operation Sacred Trust is one. And they said, let us give you the resources, open the doors to local VA so that you can build a collaboration that first and foremost is focused on saying to this veteran who's facing homelessness, you know, what are the dreams of your life? What are the circumstances you're facing? What would it look like based on your individual needs to create a bridge to that future? And then that we have the resources to actually build that bridge together with the veteran and with active support from local VA.
Yeah, and we heard from some of the veterans that your organization has helped during this time. Let's listen to some of them. Paul Osteen from Davie.
I have emphysema and pulmonary fibrosis. So after I wear that mask for a little while, I feel heat, you know, coming on and nausea and everything from breathing my own air over and over. But yeah, that thing with the mask, and then there's a lot of things, you know, that's been affected. The schools and my grandbabies, I worry about my grandbabies getting a proper education now, because when a kid's not in a classroom, their mind's going to wander.
You know, I'm wondering, you know, Seth, when you hear stories like that, how often do you hear about veterans with those kind of underlying health conditions?
Pretty much every moment of every day. The veterans that we serve were already, before COVID-19, surviving on the very edge of life, really treading water, living often from day to day, week to week. So when you throw into that the loss of any extra income they might have been able to earn, the greater expense for groceries, for all the necessary things that people need to survive, that's a very tough situation. And almost every veteran we work with has underlying health conditions. For some of them, they're visible, as in the case of Mr. Osteen. For many, they're invisible. And often these invisible wounds of war are greatly exacerbated when you throw in the kind of challenges we're facing with COVID-19.
Yeah. I'm talking with Seth Eisenberg, president and founder of Operation Sacred Trust, a nonprofit organization that helps veterans transition out of homelessness. And we're talking about how the pandemic has affected veterans in South Florida during these times. One of the other veterans that we heard from was also Chris Doble in Davie. He's a 28-year-old, and he served in the Marine Corps for 8 years.
My job up in New Hampshire got laid off and shut down. So I wasn't making any income. Took me about 3 weeks to get unemployment. And then once I had my first check from unemployment, came down here and looked up Operation Sacred Trust. And they've been helping me out. They've been getting me counseling, therapy, groceries, put me up in a place to stay. My hope is that what they're doing for me, I can do for others.
Seth, how often do you hear veterans who come from other states, they come to Florida to seek help?
So South Florida is one of the three really epicenters of veteran homelessness in the country. You've got major, you know, major concentrations of homeless veterans in California, here in South Florida, and certainly in Texas. But I think all of us who live in South Florida know what a wonderful, you know, terrific place it is to live. And for a veteran who doesn't have housing, it's not at all unusual for them to pick themselves up and bring themselves to South Florida. And that is a challenge because we certainly find that many of those we serve are natives to this area and have lived here for years. But increasingly, we're seeing through COVID-19 that as people are facing enormous challenges in other communities, they are increasingly coming here to Miami and Fort Lauderdale.
How is your organization doing right now during this pandemic? I mean, what are some of the challenges that you didn't have before?
The biggest challenge is 200 veterans in a hotel today. That we've had to grow from two operating sites in Broward and Miami-Dade County to five operating sites. We've had to go to 7 days a week staff. Our staff has grown from about 20 to over 40 just since March. And we've had to really develop expertise on providing complex daily assistance to hundreds of veterans far beyond anything that we had ever done before at this magnitude. Thank God for the VA's responsiveness in terms of resources. Our budget literally went from $2 to $3 million to closer to $6 million, so that we quickly had the resources to place people in hotels, hire the staff, do the training, and be able to provide the level of care that each and every veteran has certainly earned and deserves.
Do you still find, though, because as I mentioned before, a lot of times veterans are the last ones to ask for help. But, you know, during COVID, has that changed?
It's still a major challenge that part of your training in the military is to solve your own problems, to figure out your own solutions, you know, to keep it in. And that comes with an enormous price that often shows up in the veteran suicide statistics, which is just an incredible tragedy. But one of our biggest challenges, which is part of why I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be on your show today, is to let veterans know these are benefits they've earned. This is not charity. This is a nation in which, you know, close to 98% of us never put on the uniform, never offered our lives in order to protect the rest of this country and all of the freedoms we enjoy. So for those few that did that, whether they did it for decades or months or years, we as a community have a sacred trust. And for a veteran to step up and offer us that opportunity to fulfill that sacred trust is not charity. It's a benefit they've earned, a gift they deserve. And for them, their loved ones, the children of the future, and each person touched by their lives, they very much deserve that and should actively reach out for access.
Yeah, that is well put. I'm going to end it on that note. Seth Eisenberg, again, president and founder of Operation Sacred Trust, a nonprofit that helps veterans transition out of homelessness. Seth, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, sir. And thank you.
Well, still to come, change things up a little bit. Why are conversations better when you're sitting in a rocking chair? We're going to talk to the host of the podcast, Rocking Chair Sessions. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, artists in South Florida have countless stories to tell. And a local podcast is documenting those stories by inviting artists to sit in a rocking chair and share their tales of struggle, triumph, and, well, everything in between. You know, it's part conversation and part therapy. Maria Teresa Barbist and Elisa DiBattista are the hosts. They were inspired by the diversity of artists that call South Florida home. And so a few years ago, they started the Rocking Chair Sessions podcast. We talked to them back in July, and you can find a link to their podcast on our social media at WLRN Sundial, or you can find it in Apple Podcasts. Delisa, I mean, tell me about, you know, what is it you're trying to get to in the podcast, and why is there a rocking chair?
My background is a BFA in graphic design. Maria's background is psychology, and she did have a practice when she was in Austria and had to, you know, have conversations with people. And traditionally, when you think psychology, you think a couch. So we're like, okay, how do we figure out getting a couch into your second story art studio, which is pretty petite? She said, well, I already have this rocking chair. And so we said, you know what? It works. It's something that's soothing. People come down, they sit, they rock, and it's a casual conversation. So I think for us, the beginning of the project was more of, we were just not only interested in our own stories, but all the people that we had interviewed or just in conversation, casual conversation in Miami or South Florida, had such crazy, interesting stories.
Yeah. And highlight the South Florida art community. You know, it was really like all about who is an artist here, and how can we highlight people that are not famous, you know, that are usually don't get interviewed. So we wanted to hear those voices, and it was really, the rocking chair is really kind of creating this moment where they can also relax, and where we were like tongue in cheek saying, also it's kind of like a therapy session a little bit. It's 50 minutes. We're talking about childhood, we're talking about early influences, we're talking also about the support structure here in South Florida. Like, are there grants available for artists? Are there jobs available for artists? You know, are there studio spaces available? So it's really kind of like a survey of the South Florida art community.
Let me ask you both about your background in art, because, I mean, Maria, you, again, your background's in psychology, but then why did you get into art? And for you, what does it mean?
I got into art through this art therapy training that I did in California, and it is movement-based. So I was never a dancer, but I had to start moving or dancing and doing performances, which was like really scary for me. Like, it was so scary, I was like, I'd rather fall down the stairs than do this performance today. And then I did it, and I was just like, oh my God, I love doing it. It's not that I'm not scared anymore, but I still, like, I was just like, there was something there that I never knew about myself. And it just opened this whole window into like exploring, like drawing and painting and sculpture and film. But it's always, for me, because I come from psychology, it's always about self-expression. And it's also about, you know, dealing with trauma, with psychological trauma. So for me, everything that I do has always that red thread, or the common thread, right? That it is telling a very personal story.
Elisa, I wonder, because your background is in graphic design. But I wonder, you know, your approach when you sit down with another artist and you're talking to them about, you know, where their creativity is coming from, what inspires them, and you know, digging into these little stories. But how are you looking at those interviews and you know, the way you were trained, how does that impact the way you do your, you know, those interviews, what you're trying to get at?
The background that I feel that I bring to it is that I'm also an educator. And so the classes that I've taken in education to be able to teach, you have to learn to listen. And so when you listen to an individual who's telling you their story, you pick up on certain things. So I think observation is something that is very crucial in what we do in terms of the interviews, how the body languages of the person, what they decide to reveal, what they decide not to reveal, because we do not want to invade people's privacy. We want it to be a very casual, comfortable conversation, and whatever it is they're willing to share with us and the public, because it is an educational platform, so people could learn about these living histories that we have here in the present in South Florida. It's very much about observation of the visual, of the auditory, and also of the physical presence of the individual, whether it was in person in the rocking chair or we went virtual during this whole pandemic. So both of those scenarios. So that's how I would say that my background has helped me.
And I want to ask you about how the pandemic's changed things, but let's go to, you know, the rocking chair. What does the rocking chair look like?
I got the rocking chair from the Bargain Barn when it was still in Wynwood. I love that place. It was the first piece I got from my studio. It is very stable, yeah, because a rocking chair can be, you know, kind of scary sometimes. So it's very stable. It has like, the wood is kind of like a whitish varnish, and then it has like this pillows that are kind of bluish, and I made a blanket for the rocking chair that is turquoise. So these are kind of like the colors. So it's like white, a little blue, and then turquoise. And it's pretty beat up, I have to admit. It's old. Mm-hmm.
You know, I love the fact that you brought the chair to one of your guests. This was a Bernice Steinbaum, I believe. She had founded her own gallery in New York. And this is a clip from one of the podcasts, when you were talking to Bernice. And here she is talking about her experience at the time.
The gallery represented 50% women and 40% artists of color. Artists of color being defined as Afro, Asian, Latino, and indigenous people. Think about indigenous people for a moment. In New York, I was the only gallery that represented a Native American. That's pretty shocking. Can you imagine that there were no indigenous people represented in 500 galleries?
And again, that's Bernice talking about her experience at the time when she was getting her gallery going. But tell me a little bit, Elisa, about what you took away from that conversation with her. It was funny. It had its moments, but she had some really great stories.
So, Bernice, we have this rule that everyone over 80, we come to their place, right? And what was really cool is I have a Fiat 500, so we had to put the rocking chair into the Fiat 500 to get it over there. And then Bernice had actually forgotten that we were scheduled for the interview, and she opened the door in her white nightgown, and it was just magical. It was awesome. She was like an angel.
It was just, you know, with her big, lovely glasses. It was so New York. I couldn't handle it. It was amazing.
And I wish she would have let me take the picture, the Polaroid in her nightgown, but no way. She ran and changed, and I took the picture in her fancy outfit. But the whole trip over there was just really incredible. And now we have this only one Polaroid that has this different background, because I was always trying to keep the background with the banner and all the other rocking chair Polaroids, but hers is special. Hers is dark, and you can see some of her artwork in the background. It's really wonderful.
When you talk to Bernice and you listen to her, especially, she just envelops you in these real histories. And so it's like, you know, she's a very experienced and learned person who's just so wise. And what I learned and took away from that interview is that we need to capture these stories. We need to listen. We need to be able to have this for future generations. Us having studied art history at school, we don't always have access to things that are before, you know, recordings were available. So sometimes you just hear, oh, such and such artist was, you know, a drunkard, or such and such artist, you know, liked to go fight in bars and then go paint. And so you just hear these things, but you don't witness it or listen to it firsthand. And so in having the opportunity, and honestly, we're very grateful to have that, to just hear her out and have her share this with us and hopefully just the public, it was priceless.
No, it's a fun conversation to listen to, without a doubt. I'm speaking with Maria Teresa Barbist and Elisa DiBattista. They're the host of the Rocking Chair Sessions podcast. It's part conversation and part therapy session with South Florida-based artists and creatives who share stories about their lives while sitting in a rocking chair. You can find a link to their podcast on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You can also find it on Apple Podcasts. You know, you guys also take these Polaroid photos of the artists in the chair. You got this one photo. It's a guest, and I believe it was Astor St. Val. Wasn't sitting in the chair. He was holding it up. Why did he do that?
Well, I don't want to analyze him too much, because he used to be my coworker at the PAM. He worked as an art teacher, as a teaching artist, actually, with me together for like 2 years. So, but he's originally from Haiti, and he's definitely a strong man. And so I think what he really likes to do is not just play in a system, but think outside the box and think outside the system. And if he can subvert a system, then he really loves to do that. So picking the chair up and doing something different, like we have some artists that are always looking like, what did the others do? And I don't want to repeat that. You know, I want to do something different. And Essayer is definitely like that. Like he's definitely always like, he makes these leather bands for watches, so you could, you know, like it's a beautiful design, and it's very, very different than a beautiful wristwatch band, you know. And so he makes like all these like very out of the box things that are really, really cool. He's really mysterious, very, very spiritual, but also very like always, you know, this, yeah, I would say is subversive too, you know, like this activist as well, I would say. So I really appreciated that. He was the only one carrying the chair. There were some upside down people, but he was the only one carrying the chair.
You know, one of the other podcasts recently that you did was with a local artist, Jose Luis Garcia, and he teaches a photography class at Miami-Dade College. And that was interesting because he talked about the transition to online because of the pandemic. And this is a little piece of that conversation.
It severely shifted, going from like anti-digital to only digital. We created visual diaries, kind of documenting this time, whether it was the hectic workflow, whether it was, I had students that were photographing Purell in numerous kind of ways of, you know, all these objects and circumstances that are kind of happening. So it was great to kind of see these perspectives be, you know, comical and sometimes very heavy and deep.
And Elisa, you're a teacher. And I'm wondering how the pandemic and the thought of teaching virtually, how that's impacted you.
There was a huge, I think, learning curve for all parties involved, and also a level of trying to be understanding, sympathetic, and try to say like, hey, we're in this together. What do you need? Oh, your internet isn't working. You could text me the artwork. This isn't working. Maybe instead of using the program, which we have set up that sometimes glitches, you can maybe send me an email instead via your phone, etc. So there's a flexibility that takes place. It made me also more, I would say, adventurous with my instruction, in that there are things that they could do online at home with their parents that we didn't necessarily have access to in the classroom. So I would say it had created not just an opportunity in a tragic and kind of a very cumbersome situation.
Maria, coming back to the talking to artists, because you talk about the financial struggles, how hard has it been? How are artists getting through this?
It's been devastating at the beginning for artists, especially because so many lost their jobs. Artists predominantly have jobs that are either part-time or gig jobs. And the first time, like weeks and weeks and weeks waiting for unemployment money was just horrific, right? It was really horrific. I was also not able to access my studio because it had to be shut down for the pandemic. And so it was, it was a big shock, you know, financially. And like so many artists don't have income right now. And if they do have income, it's very, very little from the unemployment.
All right, I want one answer from each of you as we wrap up. In each episode, you ask your guests to make three wishes that will come true because the rocking chair is magical, as you like to tell them. So give me the most memorable response you've ever heard.
A few of the artists have said, and has always stood out to me, is the opportunity to have opportunities to keep on making artwork. Because as an artist, you do have to feed yourself, as Maria has said, and you don't always know, will you be able to participate in something, or do you make a project? I am currently a nomadic artist. I don't have an art studio. I make art when I have, oh, there's an exhibit coming up. How large is a piece? Where is it going to exist? I'll make it for that exhibit. I'll drop it off at Basel. I'll pick it up, whatever. But I don't have a space. And so the opportunity to have opportunities to make more work in the future, long term, is a wish that always also stood out to me personally.
I think there was only one person that did not have any wishes. Do you remember that, Elisa? That was like, I think it was one. It was just like, I don't have any wishes. I'm fine the way it is right now. And that was pretty magical to me. That was really awesome. But I would agree with Elisa. I think that the common thread through all the wishes is really that artists just would love to continue being able making art. And what Elisa mentioned earlier is that a lot of artists are moving away from Miami because they feel like it is too expensive to really purchase like a home. And so they are always paying rent for their apartment, and then they are paying rent for their studios, and it just never I feel like a lot of artists now are moving, like what we heard, South Carolina or North Carolina, or like more into spaces that are still more affordable, because time is, for an artist, it's like gold, right? If I have time to make art, that's my heaven, right? And so you have to manage all of that. You have to manage your day job, and you have to manage your family, and you have to manage, you know, when can I get myself into the studio, you know, to actually work.
And that was Maria Teresa Barbist and Lisa Di Battista. They're the host of the Rocking Chair Sessions podcast. Sounds like a good idea. Podcast from a rocking chair. You can find out more on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, September 16th. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk with former Senator Bill Nelson about the Democrats' strategy for November. Also, the Palm Beach Post has a powerful investigation into 10 years of homicides in the county and some very disturbing trends that they found in the data. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.